Hello, everyone, and welcome to another week of the podcast. There is a heat advisory here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, for at least the next 24 hours. And I think what I'm doing right now kind of demonstrates how committed to you I am, dear listeners, because right now I'm sitting in my car. It's a black car. It's hot, but I'm here to record the intro and the outro for this week's podcast. And if that doesn't say I love you, I don't know what else does. This week, I need to thank Maggie Hanley for introducing me to her very, very dear friend, Des Baugh, who stars on the EMC show Dark Winds. You can find this show on Amazon Prime and on AMC, as I stated before, and I love the show because it's filmed here in the desert Southwest. I absolutely love the show because there's a mystery in there. There's kind of a little detective story. It's a little scary sometimes. And it also beautifully kind of illustrates the Navajo, or as they like to be called, the Diné way of life. I urge all of you to binge watch this show. It is absolutely exceptional. Des Baugh is many things, as most of my guests on this podcast are, as you well know. She is an actor, she's also a screenwriter, and she's an enchanting person to talk to. We had such a great conversation, and I just found myself reveling in her wisdom and her wit. So now, without further ado, episode 128 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
That journey from that time when I'm like, no, I'm going to be working on giving to myself because I gave so much away. And I was looking so outwardly to this person who I thought was going to support me, and then they didn't. I have to support my kid and I don't know how. And you just got to dig deep. So that's me introducing myself in Diné, Bizad, Navajo, and I basically explain just what you asked, like, who are you? And I say that, you know, I am born for are born to my mother's clan, which is Mexican. So my mom's Mexican. That's where she comes from. And then I also say that I am born for my father, and that his clan and where they come from is the Ute clan. And then I also go back and I say my mother's mother's family is also from Mexico, and that's where they come from. And then my father's mother's, or my father's father's mother's clan, where she comes from, is the Salt clan. And so in Navajo, we introduce ourselves from where we come, where our clans are associated with specific areas in Dinebikea. And so that's just like an automatic, you know, where are you from? And that's how you describe who you are. And then you go on to say further, that is how I am. I have become a Navajo woman. Yeah, so that's something that, like, I actually was presented in 2016, that I actually really looked into, like, exactly like what you asked, like, who are you? Because I was going through a really difficult time in my life. And another Navajo woman was working on a portrait of me and asked me that question, like, how are you a Navajo woman? Or how would you describe yourself as a Navajo woman? And I used that starting jumping off point to reinforce, I guess, and lean into my weaknesses, what I felt like, the things that I didn't know, which is about my Navajo culture. And so how do I then identify as a Navajo woman without having grown up with my Navajo culture and what pieces I do know and what it is that I'm reaching forward to and working on becoming, and also the owning the pieces that I don't know and the pieces that I don't have. I realize I don't have this, and this, but I also have these things, and this is what I'm working on and creating in my life. So it was actually really interesting that at that particular time, this woman who was doing a portrait of me asked me that question, and then I turned it into an essay. At some point later, it was published in the Navajo Times. And I know that it really resonated with a lot of people because they were struggling and with their identity. Who are you? And it was something that really inspired me to dig deeper. Because growing up in northern New Mexico, where I grew up near north of Española, I went to school in Española, and I currently live in Santa Fe. You know, I didn't belong to either or any of the groups really. You know, I was Native American, I was Hispanic, but you know, a lot of my friends, you know, their relatives and their grandparents and their aunts and uncles were all from the area. And my parents were transplants. My dad and my mom moved to that particular area near Abiquiú because my dad worked in Los Alamos, and that was the cheaper land. And my mom, who is Mexican, grew up in Gallup, where there was a lot of Navajo people. My dad was raised by a white family up in Bloomfield, and so he didn't grow up culturally Navajo. So there was a lot of not knowing who I was growing up. And so that start of the 2016 and that question really invoked in me to dig deeper. And since then, I have continued to dig deeper as to who I am as a woman, as a mother, you know, as an actor, as a filmmaker, as a human being. What does that really mean to be in this place? And how do I then support my family and what that looks like to me? And that's just been the journey that I've been on since for the last 7 years.
You said your father did not, you know, I'm actually curious because one of the things in the kind of the behind the scenes for Dark Winds was how challenging it was for quite a few of the cast members to speak Navajo. Mm-hmm. And so was that cultivated when you were a child? Were you taught Navajo, or was your father? No. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, no, my dad didn't grow up speaking the language. You know, he knew bits and pieces, jokingly, you know, like all the bad words, but, you know, and he had older sisters and, who knew and remembered a little bit of the language, but he was always teasing him and stuff, but he never knew anything really, like all the traditions, all the songs, creation stories, you know, like none of that really, you know, nothing.
I'm wondering because I try to practice Spanish and French on my Duolingo app. And just recently, I don't know if you know this, but they have Navajo now, which, you know, I did one lesson. I was like, oh my God, this is, I don't know if I have the capacity. It's very, I don't know. It's very, it sounds very lyrical. But it's, I don't know, it, you know how Russian has completely different letters? Mm-hmm. For me, Russian was really difficult to study because my brain couldn't wrap around the different letters. Navajo mm-hmm. feels a little bit like that. Like your brain has to kind of approach it in this really beautiful, curvy way rather than engage with it directly. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
No, yeah. It's actually very phonetic, but at the same time, because it's not like French for sure, where there's like, you know, your word is 20 letters long and you only pronounce like the first two. But it's very phonetic, more like Spanish. The only difference is it is kind of more like Mandarin, and then there's tones. So like you'll go up or you'll go down, or some things like, you know, in your or nasal, some things in the throat, kind of sort of like French. I think all languages kind of have like a letter that's a throat letter. And so Navajo is a little bit like that. It's kind of like German in the sense that it's all the adjectives end up at the end. So anyone who knows German grammar would be able to understand the grammatical structure of Navajo and at least get that far.
It is actually a really gorgeous language to listen to. You don't know what is being said, but it is like this gorgeous song or chant when I was listening to it, at least. Mm-hmm. I found it really fascinating. And what I think is really quite amazing, partially because I'm going through menopause and I can't remember anything right now, is that, you know, truly, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the most of the native peoples on this continent did not have really a written form of relaying information. So it was all or stories, and so everything was memorized. And so these beautiful stories or information were communicated through language and then memory, which I need help with right now. But I just think that is such an astounding feat, partially because of my own challenges. But I think that, you know, over the hundreds and let's say thousands of years, you know, those stories, that information is being transmitted and then also evolving, right? Because new information would come in. And was a lot of the information, I would assume, for the entire, you know, tribe, and I want to use the correct language here because I want to, but I've also understand that the language is challenging because different First Nations peoples use different words. But is tribe the right word to use? What would you use?
I say the Navajo Nation, and you know, okay. Usually. Yeah, so we refer to like the nation. So in that context, it's important, yeah, to establish because it's a sovereign nation. All tribes, all different native reservations and federally recognized tribes are considered sovereign nations. And I think that's necessarily important for the very fact of understanding sovereignty and what that means in relation to the federal government, that you're basically interacting with another country. And a lot of times people may not understand that when it comes to like, you know, when it comes to like healthcare or money or taxes and that sort of thing, I think the general public doesn't realize why treaties, you know, are important because it's a, you know, a document that's signed between two countries as to how to interact with each other. And it's not like a law per se, it's something a little bit higher, different. So just understanding that some people might, you know, refer to tribe, you know, in tongue in cheek or joking or, you know, hey, I'm, you know, I got my tribal ID. But really kind of understanding what that means when you say nation, it's a completely different entity in itself.
But as I was, you know, just my question, like, were those stories, were those oral histories, were they known by everybody who lived in the nation or?
Well, culturally, yeah, no, it's I think in some ways that's kind of a little bit like a romanticized version. And I think, and I say that in a way that it's not as if what has happened that we, like the question that you're asking, and it's like, wow, it's so amazing that this has been an oral tradition. That's just the way languages are, you know, when you look at it. The English language, how it came about, the Canterbury Tales, Beowulf, you know, the Germanic languages, they all started as oral stories. The Odyssey, you know, everything. And then someone was able to put all these little symbols together and come up with this quote written language of our utterances, our vocalizations into quote this written word. And so I think that when I say romanticize, this is like, wow, that's so interesting. But it's not anything different that hasn't happened before. It's just that this is something that you can kind of see, I guess, in real time, maybe. I'm not sure that I'm saying that right, but it's not something that we see currently today all the time. That, oh, wow, the capacity of human thought to see the process of that still continuing today, where it wasn't until like maybe the 60s or somewhere around there when Robert Young and his colleagues were able to put together a dictionary of the Navajo language and a written form and to come up with a dictionary, right? And so it's, and you kind of just, it's fascinating to see the progression of thought transmuted through the written language, I guess. There's a difference between literacy and fluency. So a lot of the times, you know, elders will be very fluent and they'll be able to describe things with their old way of saying things. And Navajo is very descriptive. And so it's not so much just like there is a word for one thing, like you're saying, it's always evolving. And language itself is really always evolving. You know, Webster's dictionary is always adding new languages to the dictionary and they're kicking some other stuff out, right, that we no longer use. And kind of similarly, there's like this introduction of new words. How do you describe this? And I don't know Navajo, but it's like, you know, well, how would you describe a cell phone where it's the thing that you talk into your hand, you know? So that would be like the literal translation of what the Navajo description was. And also hand in hand too is the reason why Navajo was used to end the war, because of that descriptive language, because we were able to move around in these different ways. And it really has to do with thought process and describing, which again goes back to, wow, humans are able to create thought, think of something, see something, and then describe it, and then it's able to be translated and told to someone else, and they're able to understand it as well. And you have to really juggle your brain in order to be like thinking that this descriptive word is talking about this particular thing. And it's really kind of almost like, I don't want to say this in a derogatory way, but like a step back in time to human thought, as you know, how do we describe a cat? How did the cat become a cat? How did a dog become a dog? And it's just this process of describing these things. Oh, this giant beast with fur who comes and sits at my feet became dog. And I feel like that's part of maybe the beauty and the romanticism of the Navajo language, of like, oh my gosh, wow, it's so beautiful. Because of the description, because we've held on to something that we've used for thousands of years.
Well, I'm so intrigued to kind of hear the story or understand, like, did you grow up in a religious household, or what did that look like as a child?
Yeah, I grew up in a religious household. I grew up Southern Baptist, and I was in the church before I was even born. And that was in part because my dad's mother, who raised him, the white family he was raised by, they were Protestants. And my mother was raised Catholic, but she wasn't like a devout practicing Catholic. Her dad only had her baptized just to be good with the community and to ensure that she went to heaven. And so, yeah, I was completely raised as a Southern Baptist and continued to go to church, I think, up until the time that I graduated from high school. Yeah, I remember Sunday school, crackers and juice. I learned pretty much all the stories. I think I knew at one point all the books of the Bible, had those memorized. I still have a lot of verses memorized. I still find a lot of the verses that I learned growing up. I love to be singing in the choir. I attended, you know, youth camps, vacation Bible school. I don't want to say like I was fully indoctrinated, but I have since, from especially from me recovering my roots of my native upbringing, my native culture, the Navajo culture, I have since very much moved away from believing in the church and believing in that. I still find that there's a lot of similarities, and it's funny that I feel in understanding my culture as a Diné woman, I actually find more relevance in the teachings of the Bible. I find more relevance in living my life apart from the church and away from that in the verses of the Bible than I have found actually growing up inside the church.
I do want to just ask, and if this is too personal, which it might be and it might not be, feel free to say no. One of the things that I found most beautiful in the show Dark Winds was when they had the ceremony for the young girl who had her first menses. And it was just absolutely, I've read about it before, but just seeing it depicted was really kind of glorious. And I thought, what an incredible, just, you know, yes, it did look hard. It was difficult, right? The grinding of the corn, and they're like, grind it finer. And then the running, all the running. And I just, you know, when I was watching it and I was thinking of the 100-degree day we were having. And I thought, oh my God, I hope she, you know, when this happened, you got to run when it was like maybe 70. Maybe 65, but it was such a gorgeous, gorgeous example of this incredible community coming together, support, but also kind of this incredible threshold for her to step over, you know, from I guess being a child into womanhood. Were you able to experience that when you were growing up?
No, I didn't. The Kinalda is it is a beautiful ceremony, and I hope to, I have a 10-year-old, so I hope to get my act together and get all the supplies needed and necessary for her for when it's time for her. But no, I didn't. I have a story, and so my story is always long, but I have a story about like my own version of that I happened actually this year. I felt like that happened for me in lieu of what I didn't have growing up, because it was more my mom actually who really, despite the fact that she didn't know anything, but she was the one I think who first really like emphasized and told me, you know, you're Navajo, this is who you are, this is the dress. And I had a moment when I went to Montessori school for first kindergarten and first grade, and instead of Halloween we would dress up from the countries we could choose. And so one of the countries that I chose was Mexico for my mom, and then the other country that I chose was the Navajo Nation. And so that was my first memory of what it meant to be Navajo, was wearing a version of traditional dress and then coloring the flag for the Navajo Nation. And she put my hair in a Navajo bun. So that was like the first understanding of being Navajo. And that was my mom. And of course, you know, that's where you get all your teachings from in our life, is, or absence of, is from our mothers. So in some ways, I'm glad that even though my mom's Mexican and my dad's the one who should have taught me, my mom is the one who is like, no, you're a Navajo woman, or you're a Navajo child, and this is, you know, who you are. And so I didn't have the Kinalda ceremony. But yeah, it's a very beautiful way of honoring womanhood, because again, to go back to this journey that I've been on since 2016, it has been to like, who are you as a Navajo woman? And I think that that was something that I hope to establish with my own child. This is who you are. And it's a support and it's a structure that you can graft your life onto and go back to in terms of, I am strong. I come from a very strong tradition, or not tradition. I come from a very strong culture. I come from a very strong people, and I can rely on my own strength as a woman to support me and to support others. And I feel that in honoring that through the Kinalda, that's important. And a lot of women, a lot of us miss that, you know, in our own ways, not just Navajo culture, but, you know, either womanhood is shamed. We don't like our bodies. We see ourselves as weak. There are all these negative aspects to being a woman. That's just what it's like being a woman. And being as a Navajo is very matrilineal matriarchy, you know, really honoring that system of the strength that we have as women, as the feminine, to support ourselves, to support our families is so vitally important. We are creators, and to see that as our ultimate strength. So I really hope that in me returning to my cultural teachings, that I can instill that in my daughter, and that this is not a patriarchy. It never has been. It's never been about the church. It's been about our own strength as people and where we come from, and how do we support our community? How do we support our families that way?
Well, I want to ask, obviously you're in the show Dark Winds, and I do have to say that, you know, that really gut-wrenching scene, you are just magnificent, just of the, you know, when the sheriff comes to tell you that your daughter has been killed, you are incredible, just like the pain, and the whole series is just, the scripts are just incredible. They're just really challenging and beautiful and dynamic, but your performance was gut-wrenching for me. It was totally gut-wrenching. When you were a kid, were you like, I'm going to be an actress, or this is something I want to do?
Yes and no. I didn't recognize it really until later that I had always wanted to be an actor when I was growing up. I mean, I remember my nose being like this far away from the TV screen. I don't know why. I guess maybe because by getting closer to it meant I was a part of the story, I guess. I don't know. I love watching TV. I would crawl out of bed to get up and watch the late shows after Letterman or whoever was on. Of course, my mom would get mad at me. But I love watching TV. I loved fantasizing that I was going to be the cute kid that got to kiss the cute boy. And, you know, that I was Wendy when, you know, Peter Pan came and took her and stuff. And, you know, I could fly. And just really thinking that, like, these things could happen. And it kind of did, because it did. But I also just realized, you know, my fantasies back then were just so way out of line with what I, you know, given the circumstances. I'm like living out in the middle of nowhere. There are, like, LA is not next door. I mean, little did I know it really kind of sort of was, but LA was not next door. There is no way on earth that I could possibly be living the dream that I am living right now, of something that when I was, you know, 6 years old, 12 years old, wanting to do. And, you know, I was living in Massachusetts, and fast forward several years, I was living in Massachusetts, and I remember watching Black Mass with Johnny Depp. And, you know, it's like the whole Whitey Bulger. And I'm just thinking, wow, my gosh, you know, like they were filming this right here. And it just all of a sudden just hit me. They were filming this. Johnny Depp was right here when they were filming this. This is such an incredible piece of work that this guy is doing. And Rory Cochrane, I remember I had a huge crush on him growing up Empire Records. And I'm like, and that's Rory Cochrane. Like, he's on, you know, that's him. And he was right here in Massachusetts. I'm like, I could do this. I could totally be, you know, this person. And little did I ever think that, like, a year later, really, after I saw that in the movie theaters, that I'd be moving to New Mexico and that I would be involved in the film industry here, back home of all places. circling back and being, you know, an actor working with Rory Cochran, which is like dream come true. He's such a great person too. But yeah.
I'd love to hear any stories that you'd like to share of anything magical or miraculous that have that's happened in your life.
Oh my God, too many to share. I just have to kind of pick one. Everything in my life has really been, you know, my eyes were opened really in 2016 when I say that my life fell apart. You know, I had been with my daughter's father for a while, and I kind of consequently brought them to New Mexico. I'm always trying to find a way to come back home from being away. I mean, I loved being away. I love living in New York. I love living in Boston. That was great. And I loved the vibe. I did like the culture, the fast paced. I'm a fast person. So I love that. But I was also missing home. I was missing my family. I was missing the food, missing the desert. And I was always trying to figure out how to get home, but like, I couldn't just like come home. I had to have a reason. And now I'm moving away from having a reason just because I want to. That's reason enough. And so I got a job working for the Navajo Nation on a whim. And so I brought my kid with me, had my mom help me out. She stayed with me in Gallup for most of the year. And she helped take care of my kid while I was at work. In the meantime, establishing, you know, daycare and stuff like that. Because you're out in the middle of nowhere and babysitters are hard to find. And my mom's like, I'll just do it for you. And then her father moved, and then I'm like the most practically romantic person that there is. That, you know, I decided to call off our engagement for very good reasons. And then stupidly decided that the best course of action, since nothing else was working, to get married. And then, of course, that quickly ended, in part because of the film industry as well. I thought I had his support, and I did. And then he turned around and took it away and said, you know, I was selfish and I was only thinking of myself. And I wasn't thinking of the family. And I'm like, that is a blatant lie. And I, of all the other millions of reasons that I had before then, it only occurred to me then the kind of person that I was dealing with, and it was just never, ever going to change. And the only thing that I could do really in this situation was for me to change myself. And so I was slowly kind of pulling away, but I needed a reason. And I finally ended up getting a reason. And I'm cutting through a lot of dramatic, traumatic stuff, which I don't mind going into. I just don't know how far depth, you know, to deal with that, you know, with this interview. But, you know, when I made the decision that this was not going to be a part of how I was raising my child, and that this was something that had to stop, I moved forward. And what I say is I took a bet on myself. And that's one of the biggest lessons that I'm still trying to remember. Bet on yourself. You're your own best bet. Talking to someone else today too, it's just like, you know, you don't have that support that you think you deserve, expect, want, desire, need. And when it comes down to it, you are only able to support yourself. And like a cottonwood tree is my big imagery lately, in part because at the jumping here to the Bosque Redondo incarceration of the Navajos in the at the end of the Long Walk. They planted the Inde, the Apache, and the Navajo, the Diné, planted a bunch of cottonwoods along the acequia, and some of them are still standing to this day, and they're huge. And one of the things that I learned about cottonwoods is that there is actually just a root system. You don't actually really cut a tree, that is just kind of like a mushroom. It's just this complex underneath the ground. And then there's a giant tap root that goes deep, deep, deep to find the water. So when I say, you know, that the matriarchy, the matrilineal, the Navajo way of life, the teachings that we have are significantly important as women, as a society, as a culture. We support ourselves. And through that system of digging deep and finding that water and finding the support and supporting ourselves so that we can grow stronger and bigger, we can provide the support to those around us, whether it's shade or, you know, a swing from the tree, kind of like the giving tree, but not so codependent. And, you know, I'm not going to give you my whole self. I'm here to support myself and others. And so then that has been the process all this time, is that growth of that system, that growth of that taproot, that growth of how do I support myself? How do I take care of myself? Because one, I wasn't taught that, you know, not to throw shade at my mom or dad or my family, but, you know, that was just not something that they gave me as best as they could. They gave me what they only knew how. And you're only as strong as the support system you have before you. And so I'm like, I'm digging as deep as I possibly can go for myself and for my future family, for my kid and those around me. You know, my kid's like, she might adopt somebody. She tells me, she's like, I'm aromantic. I don't believe in love. I'm like, okay. And so that journey from that time when I'm like, no, I'm going to be working on giving to myself because I gave so much away. And I was looking so outwardly to this person who I thought was going to support me, and then they didn't. I have to support my kid, and I don't know how. And you just got to dig deep. And that's why I'm saying, like, it's only now through me moving away from the church and moving away from that indoctrination that I really truly found the words of Jesus Christ applicable to my life. Let those who have ears hear, and those, you know, who understand these words, let them, you know, grow in your heart. And that's when I'm saying it truly, I understand that. Living in beauty, right? Wojou. In beauty it is finished. And at the end of that scene where I'm burying my daughter, Wojou na hasli, Wojou na hasli, Wojou na hasli, Wojou na hasli. In beauty, it returns, because love is only the only thing that you ever have. And it can't be destroyed. It's only transformed. So I'm working with that now in my life of how to, like the tree, filter, take in the water, you know, into my roots. And, you know, how do I allow everything to just to come back and not hold on to anything, just let it be and be a part of that beauty, be a part of love. And that's how I support, is being a part of.
for listening to this podcast. And after the credits, after the music is over, there is more of our conversation. It's a little bit of a little extra, little Easter egg after this entire episode. So be sure to check it out if it interests you. I need to thank my wonderful guest, Des Baugh, for being on the show. She had absolutely no idea who I was, but based on her good friend and mine, she agreed to be a guest, and I'm ever so grateful to her for that. There will be a link under the episode show notes to the show Dark Winds. I just think everybody should watch it. It'll give you a bit of an idea of what's going on here in the desert Southwest, of the nature of the flora and the fauna, but also give you an idea of just how beautiful it is here. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode, Justin Allen Arnold, Music L Files, Stephen O'Brien, Palash Sunvaya, Frank Schroeder, and Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to Dark Winds, the show, books, music, playlists, all sorts of delicious items. I hope lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Des Baugh. Never give up, and always remember that it's you. You are beautiful. You have something to bring to this world. The world keeps asking us as women, but also as humans, to give and give and give in so many different ways. But as I was reminded recently, how am I going to give? How am I going to have that energy to put out into the world if I don't take care of myself first? So be like Des Baugh. Honor yourself. Honor your gifts. Honor your way of being in the world. And take care of yourself. And then with a more balanced life, you can go out and make this world a beautiful place. I don't know if you just saw me jump, but there was a huge thing of thunder just there that scared the crap out of me. So totally just flinched. I'm so sorry. tell you that I really, really appreciate, well, at the end of the season of Dark Winds, they are, the word beauty, I think, is so important. And I started crying when they were burning the Letterman's jacket on that fire. And I'm going to totally mess this up, but they say something like, there's beauty in the under us, there's beauty above us. Like, I mean, this whole incredibly gorgeous scene. And I just thought, so many people, if we just walk through our lives understanding that, you know, just in general, that there's beauty in front of us, behind us, all around us, that we're surrounded by beauty. It just really struck this chord for me. And I did start crying. I'm just going to admit that, because it was just this gorgeous, gorgeous reminder. Mm-hmm. And so you speaking about it, you know, talking about beauty. And I also think, I also thought to myself, you're talking about love, and the greatest of these is love. And I thought to myself, okay, so is love encompassed inside beauty, or is beauty inside love, or maybe both?
Mm-hmm. So that's part of the beauty way prayer, like both the Wajo Nahisri and then also Wajo Sitsiji. It means, you know, there's the different directions: beauty above me, beauty below me, beauty before me, beauty behind me, beauty within me. And it's just, and it's really, Wajo is just like a way of life, like balance, beauty, love. It's all encompassing of those things. It's really what it is. Again, the creation, you know, God, what is that? What is God? It is pure love. And, you know, sometimes we get so hung up on joy and happiness, thinking that like, oh, that means that like the world, like the birds are singing and, you know, there's just, you know, and then there's bad and there's ugly. And then it's like, oh, there's this and this. And what I really come to understand is just, it's like, there's this, like, it's like almost none of those things. It is just this contentment. It is a being a part of, because you can't really be a part of, and you can't really, you know, like you, it's just, it's a mixture of all those things. And it's not really so much like bird singing and being in love and giddy and butterflies in your stomach and that sort of thing. That's like a feeling. It's really, there's like this peace and there's like this knowing and there's like this understanding. And one of the things that I do love about my, no, I mean, there's many things, of course, but one of the huge things that I love about my Christian family, my mom, my dad, is I can really talk to them about anything. And even my crazy, you know, transition from being, you know, this God-fearing, Jesus, Bible-thumping type of upbringing to just talking about, you know, Alan Watts. And, you know, this idea that, you know, we are the creators, we are God. And what does that really mean? And having this conversation with another friend of mine is, if we really truly understand our power as human beings, in the sense that we are so capable of both beauty, ugly, death, destruction, creation, love, loving all those parts of ourselves that we don't like, that don't make sense, and being okay. I'm okay, right? I love everything. I you know, I see the flaws in me and you, and we're okay. You know, there's a lot to all the other religions as well. Kali, death, destruction, chaos, renewal. In death, there is life. You know, in life, there is death. And, you know, once we're born, we start dying. And is death really ugly? And, you know, this idea that all of these things combine. So when we talk about like beauty and love, it's not beauty and it's not butterflies of love. It's like there's a balance. And there's a contentment and there's like this process, and it's always moving and changing and being and evolving. And there's never like a finite sense of black or white. It's always just kind of this entity. And so we can call that God, we can call that love, but we also have to recognize that it's not outside of ourselves. It is within us. It is all around us. We are a part of that creation. We are a part of that love. We are a part of that beauty. We recognize our full capacity as creators, as love, also destroyers. I'm going to go see Oppenheimer tonight. And what that really means, that in a blink of an eye, things can go and also become.